Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens would mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by journalist Lucy Hamilton, who studies the Atlas Network. Thanks for joining us again, Lucy.
Thanks, Cam and Andy. Good to speak to you again.
I guess just to begin with, where to begin? There's been so much going on. What do you make of Barnaby Joyce and his possible leadership of One Nation?
Very interesting indeed. I think it suggests that there's quite a few of them thinking that the LNP is a dying brand. It's intriguing to think that he might feel that the One Nation option has legs. I think we should all be watching to see whether there are any of the big sort of right-wing strategic forces like the fellas around Advance who might think that promoting One Nation with Barnaby Joyce at the helm is something they could clean up to drive for Australia. But we'll have to see.
How serious do you think is the apparent split within the LNP? Do you think that a new far right is a real possibility? And how do you see the position of some of the people you've discussed in relation to this question, including, I guess, Advance and the other organisations you've written about?
Well, it seems to be a lot of very wealthy people with a lot of connections who are very keen to promote a very far right politics internationally, and they're networking and promoting each other's projects and strategies. So we see it coming up with, you know, talking points that sound like they're straight out of MAGA and things like that coming up in Australian politics and discourse. It's you've got really, you know, powerful forces on some level with Murdoch, who's, I think, right entrenched in the national conservatism space, which is part of this on the transnational scale. It's going to be really tricky because, of course, we've got preferential voting and compulsory voting that does protect us somewhat from the extremes of politics that the US and UK are susceptible to. But we also have some very weak branches, and the far right forces have been besieging them, as we've said before. So it does mean that there's that risk with our very broken information space in Australia and our very poor news service that people might end up voting for the kinds of candidates that they don't understand how radical the agenda might be if they win. So I think that's our big risk. But I think there is certainly a heap of energy dedicated to building that in Australia.
Compulsory voting, for what it does to keep things in the centre, which is supposed to be, yeah, the antidote to all of this. If the Overton window has shifted significantly enough, the centre becomes quite a nasty place.
Yeah, representative politics, when you're representing something as poisonous as the MAGA movement, isn't terribly desirable.
What do you see from the reform example in the UK in what we're seeing here in Australia?
If you look at the research done by Nafiz Ahmed, who writes with the Byline Times, a UK media brand, he says that in around 2012, Steve Bannon was working with Farage to try and forge a kind of Tea Party movement in the UK, which is the proto-MAGA force in America. So there's been a really concerted effort to build around him and Brexit this kind of nativist populist radicalism and intense racism. So the news that came out today was that James Orr, ORR, has been made an official advisor to Reform, and he's a serious power player. So he comes out of Cambridge's Faculty of Divinity or Theology, whatever it is, and he is networked throughout this national conservatism, various brandings around the place. So he was the one who was apparently responsible for getting eugenics on the menu at Cambridge. And that process appears to have led to the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship that's headed up by Jordan Peterson, but has sort of Tony Abbott, John Howard, John Anderson, Andrew Hastie, Jacinta Namajimba Price, and Amanda Stoker all on the board. And they are there with a lot of really quite powerful forces in this far-right movement. So Orr is on the board with them there. He's also an original signatory to the NatCon statement, which is a collection of some of the forces around this kind of politics. But he's also on the board of the Edmund Burke Foundation, which is the body that drove NatCon. And that is a really interesting force. So I think it probably comes out of Peter Thiel operations. There are a bunch of Catholic authoritarians on that board, but there's also a really strong sort of Israeli settler contingent driving that force. So it's the kind of intellectual or self-styled intellectual end of Christian nationalism. And it's got this very big Zionist contingent of extremist Jewish nationalists as part of that organizing strategy. So interesting to see how all that develops. But so Orr's doing all that and is now an official Reform advisor. So he's giving a kind of clout, an intellectual sort of veneer to the very nasty populist nativist Reform kind of politics. But he's also connecting it overtly instead of unofficially to this huge coalition of forces around NatCon. J.D. Vance looked to be soft-launched as the vice presidential candidate at a NatCon conference. There's a lot of big names there.
Lucy, you've written about the LNP and Christian nationalism previously. One of the arguments, I guess, that's put against the idea that Christian nationalism could become a major force, if it isn't already in Australia, is because on the one hand, as you've already articulated, we have a slightly different preferential voting system, but also culturally speaking, the United States is understood as being one of the centres of a certain interpretation of Christianity. What, I guess, possibilities do you think there are for Christian nationalists of one sort or another, whether within the LNP or outside of it, to actually influence Australian political culture and, in a sense, I guess, employ the Overton window to make the kinds of ideas that they're proposing and seem to have some degree of popular acceptance in the United States be transformed or transmitted over here?
I think the Christian nationalist forces that really are working together transnationally have a way of adapting the flavour of the Christianity that they're trying to promote for the different markets. So in Australia, it's being used, I think, as a label for all the various forces that are antagonistic to the modernity and plurality, which they call woke. And so anyone who's feeling disgruntled about the modern world can be sort of brought together around. So what you notice is that the cookers are using Christian language, the men's rights misogynists online are using Christian language, and it's a really easy way to kind of say you can't argue with my bigotry because it's mandated by God. And so there's a whole lot of different ways of Christianity being defined that's not just evangelical or rad trad Catholic. It comes across in a bunch of different ways. And in a sense, then is used as a label to vote for Western civilization, which is, you know, denoted as Christian, which can also mean voting white. So, you know, it's a really flexible term.
Lucy, you mentioned Peter Thiel before, who I've always thought of as being this sort of pragmatically evil character. You know, he's out to make a dollar. And then I discover, oh, no, he's actually, he's giving lectures on the Antichrist. What have we learned about Peter Thiel's relationship with the Antichrist in the last few weeks?
If you watch South Park, some very interesting things. Thiel is an interesting man. He, I think, was very good friends with one of the Opus Dei leading lights in America, if people look up the book on Opus by Gareth Gore. And that, I think, had an impact on him. He seems to be very much entrenched in the human biodiversity field of research, which is fake science that suggests that, you know, usually white people are superior genetically to everyone else, and that men are fit for public life, while women are only fit for nurture. And it's obviously bunk, but Thiel's movement in Cambridge that he was fostering through some of his senior people who were sent over there networking with James Orr and friends appears, according to Nafees Ahmed's research, to be very much about race science and race IQ. And you can start to understand why they're dismantling DEI. If white men are the only fit people to govern, then any attempt to balance that out with a better reflection of things is actually going against nature, because white people just are apparently superior intrinsically. So aside from that, the Thiel faction around Cambridge started up something called the Free Speech Union. And so this is now, I think, in something like 7 countries, including Australia. And the free speech they want is not the free speech to say that there's genocide happening of Palestinians at the moment. It's the free speech to say that IQ is linked to race, and the free speech to say that white people are genetically better. And so, you know, it's a really toxic movement, obviously, if you claim scientific validity for those kind of myths.
Can't believe the blood boy guy is into bad science. What happened?
You've made reference to a number of different organisations, including the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship. But I suppose one question that strikes me is there seems to be a proliferation of these sorts of reactionary lobby groups and institutions. Can you identify the main ones that operate in Australia, or the ones that you think other people beyond yourself should be paying more attention to?
It's always tricky to work out which ones are going to stick and which ones are just throwing mud at the wall. So Rebecca Clough, who's a kind of, you know, rich lister type, who's been working with Mancal, one of the Atlas Network think tanks in Western Australia, and is also on the board at the IPA, has set up something called Families for Australia, which is all kinds of, you know, reactionary resources for parents and teachers of that kind of thing. It still seems to be fairly new, and whether it actually gets anywhere will be hard to tell. So, and that also exemplifies how they're setting up these sort of culture war things, not just fighting against climate science and action. It's, you know, there's different levels of impact in different fields. So what we saw around the election was just this absolute cluster of anti-climate action front groups set up, fairly dark, to try and track down. At the same time around the election, there was a number set up of Jewish groups suggesting that there was rampant anti-Semitism in Australia that tie in vaguely to this international Islamophobia network that's been going since the 90s. So there's a whole lot of ones that some pitch towards that kind of mass market audience. And again, it's hard to know from one election to the next which ones are going to keep popping up. Advance seems to be connected to quite a few of the ones on the topic of Israel, as well as the ones on climate. So, you know, that's a play that definitely requires watching. And whether that does end up getting around Barnaby Joyce and One Nation will be interesting to see. Then there's the ones that pitch towards the elite. So the Centre for Independent Studies, which is one of the original Atlas tanks in Australia, has a division that's about society and prosperity. And they have rather more elite events where they bring out, you know, in one case, a woman who's both an Atlas Network American operative as well as an Opus Dei figure to speak about how identity politics is because we've lost our identity as children of God. So that's pitching towards a kind of an elite conservative, you know, in inverted commas, audience. So, you know, they pitch in every possible direction. The abundance movement looks like it's a centre or possibly even progressive option coming out of America, but that's actually connected to a number of the think tanks in various ways and to the tech right as another way to promote consumption with deregulation as central to it, just masquerading as a kind of green-ish phenomenon.
What do you make of Labor's seemingly very favourable response to the kind of rhetoric you'll find in Ezra Klein's book?
It's disheartening. I think, you know, Labor just does seem to be fairly happy to trot along with the Finn Review's idea of, you know, softened neoliberalism is fine. So that would work in those terms. I think they, you know, the natural party of government now, and so they just want to appease all the money figures who might either turn on them, like they turned on Rudd, or offer directorships after politics. So, you know, it's disheartening.
Speaking of billionaires turning on Rudd, is the case, I suppose we've discussed Peter Thiel's role in bankrolling a whole range of different projects. Is the same thing happening in Australia? Individuals like, I guess, Clive Palmer and Gina Rinehart, are they pouring money into these groups?
That certainly seems to be the case in Gina Rinehart's position. The woman who set up Families for Australia, Clough, seems to work quite closely with Gina Rinehart's organisations over in Perth, given that Mancal is quite well funded by Rinehart. And Clough organised the big 2024 festival called The Road Ahead, which gave Gina Rinehart a great big trophy from the Atlas Society, which is one of the Atlas Network subsets, one of their partners. So it seems to be that there is some money. I'm not sure whether Clive Palmer has a lot going on in this broader sense, but he's got Ralph Babbitt as a Victorian senator who was Clive Palmer's great success after he threw bags of money trying to win influence in politics. And Babbitt is very performatively far right on social media with a lot of performance as though he's America. And he did spend some time in America around the time of the election in November, celebrating Trumpiness.
Lucy, could you tell us a bit about groups like Church and State? And I guess, what are their ambitions? Because they seem to be, to me, quite ambitious. But then I think some of the recent wins in the States and even in the UK, people might have thought were a little bit ambitious until they happened.
Yes. So Church and State is a group that tries to promote Christian nationalism. So they stage conferences, and they were doing a hell of a lot of them around the election time in Australia, all over the place. They had their big one up, I think, near the airport in Queensland, in Brisbane. The tour this year was called Pulpits Aflame. And they have a lot of the Christian right forces geared there. They're trying to train the people who believe that Christianity should rule the nation in how to be Christians in the civic space, how to expand the vote for these Christian issues. And so they had all kinds of panel sessions, including Robbie Katter on one that was about ending abortion in our generation. So they're not playing around. They really do think that they can actually get rid of abortion. So in America, it took 50 years from the time that the Christian right decided that was the mission they were going to to use to fight through to power. And they've very clearly pretty much got there now. So you know, whether that can cut through in Australia with the kinds of audiences they're targeting. And certainly the Pentecostal numbers in theory are growing. So it'll be interesting to see whether they can get traction behind that. It's scary.
Lucy, obviously what's going on now is very important to understand, but I also understand that old mate Tone Abbott has published a book recently about Australia and its glorious history. How important do you think it is to understand Australian history, and how do you think it's deployed or utilised in the support of various reactionary political projects?
It's really important. So we all remember the black armband wars, where the old history conservatives were sulking about having to see history in a new way as various forces tried to retell history, factoring in voices that had been erased before. And that continues, obviously, with this lot. So Tony Abbott just had an interview with John Anderson, who's one of the in theory, founders of the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship, and has a very reactionary Christian nationalist podcast with, you know, sometimes quite substantial viewing figures. And they were very dedicated to the idea that Australia was both a Christian or Judeo-Christian and an English nation. So, you know, they did admit that there were massacres of First Peoples, but then celebrated all the good white men who actually, you know, put things right. So the story that Abbott's telling is more balanced than they used to be, but he's definitely still trying to entrench these, you know, white male heroes who came and made things okay again. So the purpose of the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship is telling a better story. And there's another new book that people might like to look up by Quinn Slobodian called Hayek's Bastards, where he looks at the elite force that's kind of the centre of the neoliberal project, the Mont Pelerin Society, and the kind of debates they had, where they were having arguments, you know, relatively recently, within recent decades, about whether it was white, you know, white genes or Western civilization that made the West so superior and compatible with capitalism. And they, you know, it was really entrenched all the way back, that kind of attitude. So, you know, the way history is told is what Alliance for Responsible Citizenship is for, and they're really angry at the attempt to balance out the telling of history with new voices, and are very sulky. And it's that, just that thing again, I guess, of being forced to share the microphone when you haven't had to before feels like an attack and an erasure rather than just a slight rebalancing.
Lucy, a lot of these groups in the Atlas Network just very coincidentally seem to push things that jive with the interests of the financiers, especially as it relates to fossil fuels and climate change. We are, of course, in the midst of a climate crisis that is only going to become worse. It seems like the sell's going to become a lot tougher as time goes on. Where do you see these groups pivoting when climate change becomes undeniable? As climate change becomes increasingly undeniable, like it is already at that stage.
Indeed. Floods around the world at the moment. I think we all hoped that if we couldn't get ourselves acting beforehand, that it would happen once the crises got really dramatic. But what we're seeing now is that the cooker end of things, they're blaming catastrophes on them, so the governments or Jewish people engineering the weather. And at the elite levels, I think there's just the eugenics thing, I think, is really crucial. So they just do not care how many people die or how awfully they die.
Lucy, speaking of insouciance, one thing that struck me about the August 31st marches for Australia, or white Australia, as I prefer to term it, was the fact that a relatively small group of well-known neo-Nazis were able to insert themselves into the leadership of this movement, which attracted the support of many thousands. I'm wondering if you think that, well, what do you make of that situation? And secondly, given the, I guess, concerns that are being expressed by many with regards immigration, whether in Parliament or on the nation's streets, do you think that is going to be the thing that's going to preoccupy the far right in the near future?
I would imagine it's likely to. The fact is that the climate crisis is going to drive displacement. It's going to do it internally. So, you know, we potentially won't be able to keep up with the rebuilding of houses that's needed when there's too many floods and bushfires taking them out. So if you have mass, you know, accommodation crises in Australia, and then you've got people being displaced from, you know, areas around the world that are unsurvivable, the crisis of competing demands for resources is going to underlie a bonfire that the right is going to delight in flaming. So I think it's a really worrying combination of forces that's going to make this sort of racism. And then, you know, the centrist parties like Keir Starmer in the UK are absolutely jumping on the bandwagon. So, you know, one of the key figures around Curtis Yarvin, who's, you know, a far-right philosopher to the tech-right guys, and who's in the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship with our politicians, is Maurice Glasman, who is driving Labour more towards the right. So he operates the sort of new Vision for Labour subset out of one of the ex-Atlas think tanks in the UK, the Policy Exchange, which Alexander Downer's towards the head of. And his vision for Labour is fostered by this heavily fossil fuel funded, protest busting, Islamophobic think tank. So, you know, those sort of forces are quite close to Labour in the UK. So, you know, there's a strong chance they're pretty close to some of those sorts of social conservative forces in Labour in Australia as well. So, you know, I don't think we're going to get much pushback from that going on the kind of model we're seeing now. Hopefully we'll get someone strong who's willing to fight for better stories, which is the Alliance for Responsible Citizenship idea. We need better stories too, but I'm not sure how we get them out there.
I don't know how positive a note I thought I was going to end on with a question about what's going to happen with the extinction level event that we're facing. So that's on me. Lucy, on that cheery note, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks so much for coming on the show again. If people want to find you, you are on Blue Sky at lucyham.bsky.social, and people can find your link tree on there with lots of links to articles. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much indeed. Great to speak to you as always.
Well, Andy, that is our program. We will be back next week. See you later.
We will. See you then.
Standing Together for Public Housing is a campaign to stop the privatisation of public housing. Come to a public meeting at 6 p.m. on the 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre to have your say on how to maintain and build more public housing instead of knocking it down. 6 p.m. Thursday, 23rd of October at the Capitol Theatre, 113 Swanson Street, Melbourne. For more details, see the Standing Together for Public Housing Facebook page. The Public Housing Campaign is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.